Most of us find it very, very difficult to be objective about our own life experience and objective about our own intellectual property, the ideas we've developed. We're so used to thinking about them that we don't notice how special they are.
Welcome to Your Intended Message, the perfect place for leaders and promising professionals who want to convey the intended message for greater success. Every week, we interview experts who address the challenges and best practices to deliver your message effectively. That might be one-to-one, one-to-few, or one-to-many. And perhaps the most important conversation, one-to-self. I'm your host, George Torok. My guest today is Michael Levin. Here's three facts that I think you should know about Michael. As a New York Times bestselling author, Michael Levin is the most prolific and experienced business ghostwriter in the history of the U.S. book publishing industry. That's quite an accomplishment. Two, he has written more than 20 legitimate bestsellers as opposed to books that are pumped up the bestseller list, and multiple number one best-selling books for his clients. And three, he's been married for 23 years, is the father of four, and strives to be the man his dog thinks he is. Michael, welcome to Your Intended Message.
George, I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for having me on the podcast.
Delighted to be talking with you. And clearly, your dog hasn't read any of those books.
I don't think my dog really knows the first thing about me, to be honest.
Michael, that's quite a run in terms of writing and publishing books. What makes Michael run?
Some people say, do you ever get writer's block? And I say, no, I have writer's mortgage. And it's a function of the wife, the four kids, and the dog. The short of it is, I have no other marketable skills. Books are all I can do. And the reality is that I love books. I love everything about them. I love the fact that you can just, you know, hold one in your hands and it's got so much information in it, personality, character, you can grow from it. I love the fact that I get to be around them all day long. And I think of my job as a ghostwriter as basically being in the best grad program in the world, because the people who are the best at what they do are paying me to watch them think and to learn how they operate and go through life. So it's endlessly interesting and just learning and writing and trying to express my clients' ideas. That's what makes Michael run.
And Michael, writing a book for writing it from yourself is one skill, but then the other skill is writing it as a ghostwriter, putting someone else's ideas into words. What mental shift do you need to make when you go into ghostwriter mode?
Yeah, that's a great question, George. I met Amy Tan. I actually shot pool with Amy Tan. It's a long story. And she wrote The Kitchen God's Wife and The Joy Luck Club and a lot of other best-selling, you know, really important books. She says that whenever she was getting into a different character, she would look at her shoes and just imagine she was physically in the shoes of the other character. I don't really look at my shoes, but I do think a lot about what's this person's worldview? How do they grow up? What do they see that I haven't seen? How do they express themselves? And I'll study the transcript of the call because that's going to give me clues as to their syntax and how, and then their word choice, their mode of expression. Do they like short sentences? Do they go on as I am now? And you put that all together, and it's sort of a mimicry skill combined with the ability to write in someone else's voice and put material together. You put that all together, and you can generally find your way into somebody's voice. I mean, I've been doing this long enough. So I've been doing this for 30 years. So, you know, this is what I do.
And interesting, when you mentioned the word mimicry, it occurred to me that what you do as a ghostwriter is somewhere between being an actor and an interpreter.
I like that a lot, George. That's really true. When I'm creating a chapter for a client, I am playing the part of that client. I'm not being myself writing in their voice, I'm trying as hard as I can to be them. And as I said, to just really see the world through their eyes and speak from their experience. And it's always an exciting challenge. And then because the work is so subjective, you just have to hope that the client likes it. Sometimes they do and sometimes not so much. And the reality is that it can be shocking to see your own words in print, and it can be surprising because you're just not used to that. I like to say that when you read someone else's book, there's a double shock of the new. You're reading someone else's ideas and someone else's syntax or word choice, mode of expression. And when you read your own work, you read your own chapter, first of all, it sounds boring automatically because it sounds like you and you sound like you. You know that. You know what you sound. And then these are ideas that have been kicking around your head for decades. So I have to ask my clients to sort of set that aside and instead look at what I've written from the perspective of the reader. Is this going to get across to the reader the ideas and the vision and the wisdom that the reader needs? And if they can look at it from the reader's perspective and sort of set aside the ego and the fear, then we can get the book done. So it's an emotional process. It's an intimate process.
And Michael, I'm hearing there that, so first of all, you need to understand the mind of your client, the person you're helping write, and they need to understand the mind of their reader.
Right. And they do understand the mind of the reader, because their reader is the same prospect they've been selling to or the same client they've been serving for decades. Most of us find it very, very difficult to be objective about our own life experience and objective about our own intellectual property, the ideas we've developed. We're so used to thinking about them that we don't notice how special they are. So sometimes I'll be talking to a client. Right now I have a client who is two people who are venture capitalists, and they're telling the inside stories of some of how the most beloved brands in the world were created because they were angel investors for those brands. And they're sitting there going, are these stories really that interesting? I'm like, oh my God, they're amazing. But the thing is that they're used to them. So the good thing I've been involved with more than 900 books, and I haven't written 900, but either written, edited, published, consulted on, created, or whatever. And in those books, I read all the time. So I'm aware of what's being said in pretty much any vertical, and whether it's business, finance, consulting, coaching, and so on. So as a result, I know when a client is saying something no one else is saying, and I seize on that and I say, you know, there's the chapter, there's the key idea. And the client's like, well, doesn't everybody know that? I'm like, nope, just you. You're the only one.
Michael, when you work with a client, do they come to you realizing they have something of value, or do you need to keep reminding them that, hey, that's valuable? Say that again.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, they know that they have something to say because they've been very successful. I like to say I only work with people who are too busy to talk to me. If people aren't that busy, what do they need a book for? So they already know they're out there in the world, and this is a moment to capture their ideas, to own their space, to own the intellectual property that other people are perhaps borrowing and claiming as their own. Sometimes it's a coming out party for a 2.0 version of themselves. They're moving into a new sphere. Their financial advisor is going to a higher minimum, or a different kind of wealthy person they're serving, or a different kind of consulting client that they're going, whatever it is. So the book is often a chance to sort of commemorate this new version of themselves, while at the same time capturing the ideas that have gotten them to where they are already. Does that make sense? Is that?
Yeah. So I'm hearing there that one, see if I heard this right. So one possible sign or signal that you might be ready to write a book is when you're going through a major change in your own growth, own development.
Yeah, that's true. One of the times to write a book is when you're about to make a great leap forward in your career, and you want the world to understand who you are, as opposed to seeing you as who you've been. And then at the same time, there are other folks who are most of the people I work with. As I said, they're already successful. And they just simply, they want more. You know, they want more clients. They want more assets under management. They want more fame. They want their brand to be out there in a bigger way. They want it to be easier to acquire new clients. They don't want to have to, get out there and speak or hustle or do all that. They want the book to do the work for them. And that's what books do. Books are magic. I always say that when you do a book, magic happens. You cannot predict from which direction the magic will come or what it will look like. But time after time after time, the results for the clients are indeed magical.
Do most of your clients use the book as a marketing tool?
George, they do. They use it as a marketing tool for themselves, for their firm, for their brand, or even for their ideas. Sometimes the key goal of a book is to get ideas out into the marketplace of thought. I had a client who is an MD in a rural area. This goes back about 6 or 8 years, maybe more now. And this was a couple of years after Obamacare in the United States, the new health approach had come in and taken root. And in his area, they had really figured out how to make it work on a community level, how to bring together the firefighters who might go out to a house and how to send a social worker with them and how to have the hospitals and doctors all get together so that they weren't issuing the same narcotic to the same patient 10 times when it should, and so on. So he didn't need to make money from the book. That wasn't the goal at all. It was simply, we've got something that works and we want to show the world what it is. And that's why he did the book. And I think that was the effect that the book had.
So in that case, he was demonstrating, here's what we're doing, here's what's working, and give it a look.
Right. It's more about thought leadership. I mean, George, what's your experience with thought leaders? Don't they want to get out there and get their ideas out into the world? You work with them every day.
And you're right. Thought leaders have value to offer. And the best thought leaders are quite willing to share those thoughts because they'll have new thoughts tomorrow. So it's not like I'm giving my thoughts away. No, if you're a thought leader, you keep growing, you keep building on it. And yeah, thought leaders want to influence others in positive change.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's my experience as well. And this triggers the idea that a lot of times people say, well, I don't know if I should write a book yet. I should wait until I'm about to retire. And the short of it is that you don't want to think about a book as a final report. You want to think about it as an interim report. This is where I am right now in my thinking. If I have any other ideas, I'll get back to you and share those. And the beautiful thing about independent publishing, which is how most of my clients publish their books and for a lot of reasons, speed, keeping the money, control, it's really the best way to go. What they find is that if somebody comes up to them and says, hey, how come you didn't talk about such and such in your book? And they kind of slap their forehead, oh my gosh, how did I leave that out? Well, they can turn around and do a second edition the next month. And with a major publisher, you'll do a second edition if and when the publisher lets you, not just because you had another idea that you wanted to get into the book. So there's so much freedom in publishing independently and thinking of a book as a reflection of where I am right now, as opposed to where I'll be one day. And I'll add, George, if it's okay, that a lot of times people are afraid about what the critics will say. And this is true for a lot of folks. It's especially true for my clients who are doctors or scientists or people who have to have peer reviewed any material they publish, unless they're doing a book like this for the general audience. They're so afraid that somebody is going to pick them apart out of professional jealousy or sport or whatever. I always have to remind my clients, and sometimes I have this conversation as often as once a week, stop thinking about the illusory critics over there. They're illusory. No one's going to take the time to attack your book. I mean, just forget about it. It's not going to happen. Instead, think about the people that only you can serve, that only you speak to, and that your approach, your message, your background, your way of phrasing things, your way of solving problems appeals to them. You're not trying to write a book for every man, woman, and dog in North America. You're trying to help a certain niche audience with their problems. And in so doing, the rewards will be fantastic.
And that's probably extremely valuable advice, because once you I can imagine once a person has their words put in writing, they are now open to criticism from anybody, especially with social media today. And we've got to, and if we haven't learned that by now, ignore them.
That's exactly right. I mean, you do have to sort of color within the lines today, much more than a decade ago or 20 years ago, which is unfortunate because there's a lot of suppression of speech. And that's a very, very sad development in our times. But that said, people are not going to come after you. They're not going to bother with you. People are too busy, you know, doing whatever they're doing. And again, the focus is not on imaginary, illusory critics, but instead on the people who are out there who need your help. I mean, you might say, oh my gosh, there's so many books on the subject of X. Well, you know, we don't have your book. We don't have your opinion. We don't have your life experience. We don't have your solutions. So it's almost incumbent upon people to get their successful ideas into the marketplace so that others can benefit from them. It's a huge act of service. It's not ego. It's not vanity. I don't do ego-driven books. I don't do vanity books. I do books that are acts of service on behalf of the author who is using his or her life experience and professional experience in service of making the reader's life better.
So the story that you helped them write is not, well, I did this, and then I did this, and then I won this award, and then I got this award, and then I built this. So it's not that kind of story at
George,
all.
George, it's really not. And because for the simple reason, nobody cares. And when you're writing about yourself in a book, you have to put in just enough about yourself so that the reader understands that you have the authority to say what you're saying. But that's all you need to do. And you can create authority indirectly. You don't even have to say how great I am. All you have to do is just describe some of the things you've done, and the reader will say, whoa. For example, in the book that I'm working on for the venture capitalists, I asked them, give me a brief biography, and they were very reticent about that. And then when I started writing the chapter, which would have had their biography, which is not chapter one. Chapter one is always all about the reader's problems, not about the author's greatness. So we're going to put some of that into chapter two. And then I realized, you know, their real credibility comes from the fact that they invested as angels in these companies that today, one after the next, are huge, huge, huge brand names. That's all the credibility they need. And then let the reader speculate, who are these people? Let that be part of the process to keep them glued to the pages. So you don't always have to, you know, you don't always have to sit there and say, I did this and I did that, and who cares?
Michael, what about the individual's flaws or failures? Would you include that in this story?
Irrelevant. George, that's a great point. I have he's not a client yet, but I'm hoping he will be soon. He's a prospect. He's a very, very successful person in the financial advising space. And he is very open with me, and he's very open with people about the fact that he was arrested and convicted of a charge not related to financial services when he was in his 20s, much older now. And one of the questions that we're going to have to answer is, does this go in the book? And if so, how is it treated? Thinking about another example, I don't know if you remember Tim Donaghy. He was an NBA referee who was convicted of feeding information about games to the mafia and here in the United States and occasionally in Toronto when he was there. And he came to me and he said, I want to get a book out. I did what I did and I want to tell my story. And I said, okay, fine. And I think the first chapter needs to begin with the words, I'm guilty. Just start off and say, I did it. And this is what I did. And these are the circumstances. And then you can get on to whatever your message is. Because if you dance around the issue, and if you're a public figure and people know about it, and you haven't touched on it in some way, there's no credibility. But if you come out and say, look, let's get real here. This is what happened. I did a book for Doug and Jackie Christie, who are NBA. Doug was in the NBA for many years, played for Toronto, I think, for some time. And just a great player, great guy. Doug and his wife, Jackie, wanted to do real estate after they retired in Seattle. They both grew up in Seattle. They both grew up in poverty, and they wanted to create really high level, lower income housing. And the Seattle real estate wouldn't take them seriously. So we did a book and we literally crashed it out in 6 weeks. I've done a bunch of books in 6 weeks or less. If people need books quickly, we can do that. And the point of the book was to tell his side of the story, because the NBA had labeled him as sort of an oddball, and for the craziest reason, because he's faithful to his wife. Whoever heard of such a thing? He ran contrary to the bad boy image in the NBA. He ran into all kinds of problems, and he went from team to team, and it really wasn't fair at all. So we were able to tell his story, and then that way they were able to share the book with their potential business partners and accomplish what they wanted to accomplish, which was to create better opportunities and futures for people who grew up the way they did. So sometimes you have to, you know, a book is a great way to shift the narrative and control the narrative about yourself. If there are things out there already that need to be explained away, but you can't do that on a website or a tweet, or it just doesn't work. A book is phenomenal for readjusting a public image.
Michael, if there are business leaders listening to this podcast and they're thinking, gee, I wonder if I could write a book, if I could have a book, what litmus test can they perform to see if maybe there's something there?
I think that just about everybody has something to offer. So I wouldn't get into a whole question of, you know, do I have anything to offer? Do I have anything to say? That whole self-pitying thing. If you're a successful person in the business world, then a lot of people have voted with their banking account, with their bank accounts and their credit cards and so on to say, yes, you have something important to offer. The people I work with, I only work with people who are positive people with a positive message. I've done books, you know, on occasion for folks who, you know, weren't quite at that level. And I didn't enjoy the experience, and I've decided I've got too much gray hair, and I'm not bothering with that again. So, you know, if you're thinking about getting a book out, why not? It's fun. My clients, my process requires really less than about 20 or 22 hours over the course of 4 months in order to get the book done, and so it's not a huge imposition on your time. And books always fall victim to the tyranny of the urgent. It's always like, well, I'd like to, I'll do it in Q3. No, you won't. If you have the idea to do a book, run with that idea, whether it's with me or with anybody or yourself, get it done, get it out there. Because that motivation, that feeling about, I want to get a book out there, it may not come back. So you want to grab it. But please don't think, oh, I have nothing to offer, because you wouldn't be where you are if that were the case.
Michael, when you work with people and you need to get into their head to understand how they think, how they write, how they talk, is there ever a case where you just don't like the person?
No, I love all my clients. There have been, on some occasions, people whose backs I was happy to see. I won't lie. I think we all go through that. By and large, the people I work with are really wonderful people. They're not just great at what they do. They're really great human beings. They're great family people. They're great people in their communities. I don't like the expression giving back, because that implies that you took something that wasn't yours, but they're givers. They give, they're generous, they're kind. And I really enjoy the work. I knew a business consultant who said that he would never take on as a client somebody he wouldn't have dinner with. And I thought that's a great line. Lunch, what's lunch? But dinner is a little more intimate of an experience. So it's the same way. There have been people who have been ungracious, let's say. But, you know, you just kind of roll with it, and you just kind of suck it up and get their book done as best as you possibly can. And just accept the fact that it's a big, bad world out there. Not everybody's going to like you. And, you know, pull up your socks and get on with it.
Michael, if you could take a look in history, and if there's one person, one of historical significance that you could go back and write their story, is who would that be?
George, that's a great question. And the simple answer is my mother's father, whose name was Walter Graubart. He was born in Sanok, Poland in 1908. and he was 12 in 1920 when he realized that Poland was going to be no place to live between the poverty and the destruction from World War I and the anti-Semitism and all of it. And he ran away from home, stole some bottles of vodka from his grandmother's tavern and gave them to the border guards so he could get into Czechoslovakia, taught in a religious school for a year at age 12. God knows how he got the job. At 13 in 1921, he realized that Czechoslovakia was no better than Poland. And somehow as a 13-year-old, I mean, we don't let our 13-year-olds cross the street sometimes. He crossed Germany by himself and got to Belgium, where he was able to start a business and thrive. And then the war started in 39. And so he started running again and he realized we got to go. And France, Spain, Havana, and finally the States. He was 10. I was 10 when he passed away. If there's one person I could go back and really just talk to and hear the whole story from, that would be he. I've done enough books with celebrities. I think I'm all set on celebrities. I like regular people better at this point. They're a little less high touch, high demand. And you can read a lot of biographies, but that's one story that we'll never know in detail.
Wow, what an inspiring story that is. Wow, that is something. And yeah, you're right. How many people today even thought of doing anything like that when they're 10 or 12?
George, it's mind-boggling. It's really mind-boggling. I mean, you know, the average 12 or 13-year-old, our kids are pampered and, violin lessons. And it's great. It's really great. As a father, I'm very happy that I've been able to provide, for my kids. And then at the same time, I look back just a generation or two and I think, how are we going to teach our kids resilience? And how are we going to teach our kids to go through a pandemic and say, something, it's just not that big a deal ultimately. And I'm going to get through this and I'm going to keep living my life and come out on the other side and be okay. How do we teach patience? How do we teach bouncing back? When we haven't been really tested. And, thank you, God, we haven't been really tested in anything like that in a long time. But at the same time, it is a nagging question. How could I have done what he did? When I was 12, if things had been that way where I lived, would I have had the courage to run away from home and teach school and run across Germany? I mean, it's mind-boggling. I just don't know. I don't know if... I think the previous generations were made of sterner stuff, and we are standing on the shoulders of giants, or we're slouching on the shoulders of giants, is what I would say.
Mm. Michael, do you write fiction?
I do. I've written fiction my whole career. I published 3 novels with Simon & Schuster in my late 20s, published 2 more novels with Putnam Berkeley a few years later, and I continue to write fiction, and I've done a lot of business fables, business novels for my clients, and they're really fun. I'm glad you asked that, George, because it's a great way to differentiate yourself in the marketplace. I mean, ultimately, there's some topics there just aren't that many new things to say about those topics, and yet there are people who are making a great living, getting out there in those areas. And then when they want to write a book, it's sort of like, how do I differentiate, that book from the ones that are out there? And that's why fables are really such powerful tools. Because stories stick with people. Our minds are just built to receive and retain stories, much more so than facts. And if you can tell a story or have somebody tell a story for you that's really, really compelling, you're going to be able to dine out on that book for decades. So yes, the short answer is yes. I do write fiction, George, and I love writing fiction.
Mm-hmm. And what do you do to take a break from reading and writing?
What do I do? I don't know, because I never have. I mean, I'm a total book nerd. But at the same time, I'm an armchair athlete. I run a lot of marathons. I'm going to run the Boston for Dana-Farber for my 10th time this April. People can go to michaelrunsboston.com if they want to contribute to to my fundraising. I'm 5,000 away from hitting 2,000 lifetime for Dana-Farber. Which is a great institute for cancer research and treatment. So I do a lot of that. I'm involved in my community. And as I said, I've got four kids and I travel a lot, and I travel with them, without them, with my wife, for work, whatever. Love that. And I always say that if I didn't have such great kids, I've never put so much time into them. But, you know, so that's that. And that's a huge, to be a father is just a massive privilege, is how I see it. The fact that, you know, the universe or God or whatever you want to call it would entrust me with four human beings and say, you know, here, you know, you take care of them for me. And that's a big deal. So I'm all about my family, and I'm all about trying to take care of myself and stick around and see what happens next.
Michael, for those who might want to have a discussion with you to learn more about having you help them write a book, the place to reach you is through your website.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, the website is Michael Levin, L-E-V-I-N, writes, as in writesbooks.com, michaellevinwrites.com. The email, simply enough, is michaellevinwrites@gmail.com. And my cell phone, which I will give to your audience, because I think that that only the people who really have a reason to call will call, is 617-543-3747. 617-543-3747. And I will look forward to hearing from anyone, George, in your world who might be interested in having a discussion about books and what we do.
And a reminder to our listeners, you can find the links and that information in the description below. Michael, as we're preparing to wrap up, let's take us through, what would you have in that initial conversation with a person who comes to you and says, Michael, help me write a book. I think I've got something worth giving here. What would that initial conversation look
like? I would be doing a lot more listening than talking, because I'm trying to find out what's the business purpose or the personal purpose for this book. If people have a meaningful purpose, one that makes sense, let's keep talking. If it's sort of a starry-eyed, I want to be a New York Times bestseller, you know, I've run into trouble on those occasions. So I try to, you know, back away gently from those. And then I'll explain the process. It takes 90 minutes to plan a book the way I do that. The audience, where are they? Where do you want to take them? Title, subtitle, what's going to be in each chapter? The client just sort of talks me through everything, and then I come up with that, and we share it, and we go over it. And then I just need an hour per chapter. So if it's a 12-chapter book, give me an hour, and within 7 days of, 10 days, I have to get the transcript back, but you'll have the chapter in your inbox, 10 to 15 pages. And so we're able to, you know, if you can give me an hour a week, I can have your book done in 4 months. If you want it sooner, as the Christie's did, or as some other clients did, we can do that too. But so that's basically it. I'm listening for, you know, is this someone I'd like to go out to dinner with? Is this a nice person? Is this a really, they don't have to be nice. They have to be positive. Is it a positive person with a positive message? Is there a meaningful purpose, so that if the book came out, they could legitimately expect to get the results they're looking for? And then they want to know, how does it work? And I explain that. And then we talk about fees and whatnot. And, I offer what I call a test drive, where people can do the book plan in the first two chapters for a smaller amount, and then make a go, no go decision. And that gets applied to the overall fee for the book. So that way people can, you know, sometimes people say, have you written a book like mine? And my attitude is, no, of course not. Nobody could write a book like yours, only you. So the only way you'll see what your book looks like is if we get the plan done and get the first two chapters done, and then you'll have enough information. It's sort of an inexpensive way to buy all the information you need as to what your book will look like. I don't mean to get so salesy here, but I'm just walking you through what people can expect if they call.
That's the first conversation you're going to have with Michael. My guest today is Michael Levin, reminding you that the first chapter is all about the reader's problems.
If you like what you heard, remember to like, comment, and share this podcast. Come back every week for more practical insights to help you deliver your intended message. I'm your host, George Torok.